Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in a different studio today is...
A not-so-different Jason Rosenbaum.
And...
Joe Manis.
And our first Illinois guest.
Woo-hoo. Congressman John Shimkus.
I am psyched about this show because people who know me know that I am an Illinois native at heart. Granted, it's the northern suburbs of Chicago, so that really isn't Illinois, but it counts to me. So
yeah.
It's the other world.
Yeah. And Jason also brought in a ton of cookies.
And I've had one. It's very good.
So as our guests, as our listeners know, it's tradition for me to bring in cookies for any federal guest. So again, Lacey Clay, Jason Smith, Roy Blunt, or Bill Enyart, come on down. You get cookies.
All right. Well, that's plenty of reason to make the trip. So we were talking before we started the show a little bit about your district. Tell us, you know, what all does it encompass? It's pretty.
This is how I usually explain it. There's a town, an Illinois town, on the Illinois-Indiana border called Danville, Illinois. It's about two-thirds up the state line. The home of former Speaker of the House, Joe Cannon.
Correct.
So that's kind of the northernmost part. Then I go all the way down the Illinois-Indiana border to Metropolis, Illinois, which is the home of?
Superman.
Very good. See? And then I go from the east from a town called Casey, Illinois, which has the world's largest.
I don't know that.
Wind chimes.
Really?
Oh.
And recently, and I helped measure for this, for the Guinness Book of World Record, the world's largest golf tee is there.
Wow.
How big?
It is big.
It is big.
Right. Probably the size of Abe Lincoln
and then
times
it,
two.
Then it goes all the way to really the outskirts of the St. Louis area in my hometown of Collinsville, which has the world's largest.
Ketchup bottle.
There you go.
See, I knew that.
So,
and right in the middle is the town of Effingham, which has a very large...
population of men?
Well, it's the interchange.
It has a very large cross.
Oh, yes, the cross.
I've seen that driving to Indiana.
Yeah, because I'm from Indiana, so I
drive. You did not do very well in your trivia.
I got like 50%.
Now, since I'm on this podcast, everyone will now know.
Yeah, okay.
I mean.
Well, what's the geographic, I mean, the mile-wise? I mean, your district is huge.
Yeah, I don't know. All I know is that. Sometimes I have to drive 3 hours to get to Danville, or 2.5 hours to get to Metropolis, and 2.5 hours to get to Lawrenceville. So there's a lot of driving. I have a great office staff, great schedulers. We try to efficiently use that time. There are times in this new district that I have to spend the night on the road. I'll do an evening event or two, spend the night, and then do a morning till noon event, and then try to get home.
Wow.
So not only do I have to live in D.C., sometimes I have to be on the road.
So is there a lot of divergent interests between the different parts of your district because it spans so much rural, suburban, urban?
I get asked that a lot. I think it's very homogeneous. I think it's small town, rural, agricultural, conservative, socially, fiscally. And a part of the country that they don't know, they know they're not going to get a lot from the federal government. They don't ask for a lot. So it's kind of, just rural America.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into politics. If I'm not mistaken, you went to West Point and were in the U.S. Army before, and you were also Madison County Treasurer before you went into Congress. So tell me a little bit about that trajectory till you got to the point where you're in the House of Representatives.
I was born and raised in Collinsville, so I was at a Collinsville High School class this morning. Went to West Point, served 4 years, got my degree, 5 years in the Army, 3 years in West Germany as an infantry officer, and that kind of, we're going to talk about Ukraine later on, but that does segue into my passion for Eastern European countries. I left the military to become a high school teacher. I got asked to return to the St. Louis area to teach at a small Lutheran high school.
What subject?
Well, I ended up teaching government history.
Appropriate.
At Metro East Lutheran High School, which is in Edwardsville. It's just down the road from the new Edwardsville High School there. I did that for 4 years. And when I got involved, I started getting involved in politics. Walked into the Republican headquarters. There's not a lot of Republicans at this time in Madison County.
No.
So they were very... welcoming to me, and I became a precinct committeeman, ran for county board and lost, ran for township trustee, got elected. Then I quit the teaching job and campaigned full-time for treasurer. in 1990. And got elected. It was kind of a shocker.
As an aside, I was actually just at the Madison County Administration Building. It's one of the nicest administrative buildings I've ever seen, especially the place where I guess they have their commission meetings. Is there any coincidence that they have such a nice headquarters, or is it just they know how to build good committee rooms?
Well, I was fortunate that that building was already planned and almost under construction when I got elected. So I just kind of moved into what was planned. What I like is, the fact is that they were able then to keep the old courthouse. If you know rural America, and we used to have some great, beautiful old courthouses for those counties who kept it. Now there's some who just tore theirs down, put more modern things, probably in the 50s and 60s that aren't really that pretty.
Yeah.
We still have a really nice courthouse.
Yes, you do. Yeah, I'm a big courthouse aficionado, by the way.
And then you have the administration building right across the plaza, so I think it goes well. And Edersville's the county seat, and with the university there, it's a nice community.
Now tell us how you kind of got involved in federal politics. If I'm not mistaken, you had run for Congress before you had won, or am I mistaken on
you
that?
You are correct. Good research being done.
Wikipedia is a great thing, by the way.
Well, I ran in 92 after a redistricting year, and I ran against now Senator Durbin. That was not a good year for Republicans.
It wasn't good for Republicans almost anywhere in 92.
Yeah, because I mean, that was the Clinton first elect and the wave. But I did for a guy who was running against a pretty powerful member of Congress and an incumbent, even in those days, 57-43 on a.
That's not bad.
So then 94, I got reelected as county treasurer because I was the only Republican in the courthouse at that time. Mm-hmm. So I really had – and then my first child was born. And then 96, then Congressman Durbin ran for Paul Simon's Senate seat. Mm-hmm. I got asked to look at it again, which is much better than saying I'd like to look at it again, because then you engender more support. Had a five-member primary. I won that by, I think, over 50% of the vote. And then a very, very – one of the closest races in the nation in 96 against now returned State Rep. Jay Hoffman.
Yes.
Conservative Democrat on kind of social and guns issues that's big in southern Illinois, and only 1,200 votes. So it was declared victory at 3 a.m. in the morning and held the seat ever since.
So now that you're in Congress, what committees do you sit on, and what are kind of the issues that you focus on and have been focusing on for the last decade or more?
I've been fortunate to get placed early on the Energy and Commerce Committee. Constitutionally, you can make the constitutional argument, Interstate Commerce Clause. So when you have goods and services flow across state lines, we have jurisdiction. But it's kind of morphed into an energy subcommittee, a health subcommittee, a telecommunications that deals with areas like broadcasts and internet and all this other stuff. There's an environment and the economy, which I co-chair. That's really the trash committee. So I deal with nuclear waste and other issues. Then we also have a consumer protection subcommittee and an oversight and investigation subcommittee. So my expertise is now in Washington, if members have expertise in those areas, because I've been dealing with them for now, I'm on my 18th year, so at least I can speak to broadcast issues. I can speak to spectrum or energy portfolios and the like.
Now, you also, though, have a connection to foreign affairs. You want to explain that?
Well, and there is a formal position, but it's only because I've kind of volunteered to do this. I'm a delegate on the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, which is an international organization that's found in federal law that we need to have representation. When there was a NATO, if you understand, again, looking at the Constitution, the president has two responsibilities. He's the chief executive officer, and he's the head of state. Part of his head of state responsibilities is appoint ambassadors to do foreign policy. That's why he's talking all now. That's why he's doing most of this lead on Ukraine, because that's part of his job title as head of state. Well, legislators always don't fully trust the executive branch, right?
Right.
And that's just the way the Founding Fathers designed it. So to follow on the U.S. commitments to the NATO, the North Atlantic Council and NATO itself, we have like a shadow organization called the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, where members from legislative branches from all the NATO countries and the aspirants meet regularly, officially three times a year, and then in subcommittees other times, mostly in Europe because that's where most of the countries are, sometimes in Canada, sometimes we meet here in the United States to talk about policies of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and to make sure that the legislative branches of our governments at least are giving some input to the North Atlantic Council.
Now let's transition to Ukraine because your colleague, Senator Dick Durbin, was on Meet the Press yesterday condemning this referendum in Crimea for its independence. What's kind of your take on the situation? And while I don't know if you know a whole lot about the sanctions that President Obama just leveled, what is kind of just your view of that entire situation, given your role on the NATO committee as well?
Well, and it stems from I'm biased. Obviously, I've been an outspoken critic of Putin and the Russian government for many, many years. Some of it's based upon my 3 years on the Czechoslovakian border during the old days when we had fences and walls and guards and stuff. Then it morphed when I got elected to a member of Congress. Shimkus is ethnically Lithuanian. Mm-hmm. In fact, my great-grandparents immigrated from there for economic reasons. And the Lithuanian community kind of adopted me and asked me to help them make their cause that they wanted. They were recently independent, and they wanted to make their cause for NATO membership and membership in the European Union for the same reasons that Ukraine wants it. They want the peace and security and economic development of free societies versus a totalitarian regime, even though Russia portrays itself as a federation. So that's where I've been involved. I've been very involved with that. I've been fortunate to observe one of the stolen presidential elections in Belarus, which is still under the Russian sphere.
Yeah, I remember that.
I just most recently observed the presidential election in the country of Georgia. Georgia has two of its provinces occupied by the Russians. The most recent is 2008. Any observer of Eastern Europe or the old captive nations, this thing should not have shocked anybody. It's unfortunate. But Russia's goal is to expand its sphere of influence and try to reclaim whatever's left of their old empire. And the committees of free democracies need to stand up.
Well, what should the response be?
Well, I think the response is now going to be there's going to be economic sanctions, and I think the EU is going to roll out theirs today, too. I think in the big picture, Russia is harmed by this financially. But see, I don't think it matters to Putin because they're oligarchs and they're centralized control. And so his lifestyle is not going to change. The lifestyle of the average Russian who may be, their income is based upon trade between Ukraine or the European Union, they're the ones who are going to be harmed. I think the next response should be from NATO itself, and to offer these countries like Georgia and Moldova and the Ukraine what's called membership action plan, where they officially start going down the path and transforming their societies, which means rule of law, military defense, more cooperation. A free society, capitalist type system, so that they could maybe one day be offered membership in the NATO.
I mean, there has been some saber rattling going on this end, in the last few weeks. But then some people are like, well, realistically, what can the United States do? It's not like we can send troops in or that people would want troops to be sending in. How do you see what should be said, are sanctions the most that we can do right now, or what you just talked about? But is there anything beyond that, or do people just have to kind of watch and see where Putin goes? Is this really the design of the Russian government, or is this the design of Putin?
Well, I answering the last question first, I think that Putin is strengthened by this nationalistic fervor of reclaiming the empire and moving into the Crimea. Now, Crimea is different than the rest of the eastern part of Ukraine, which may be Russian-speaking but are more sympathetic to
Correct.
Ukraine.
I was just going to say.
Versus Crimea, which is Russian.
You know? Crimea had been given to Ukraine like 50 years ago.
Right, at the Istanbul summit, or I'm not sure it was a summit, but Istanbul, where they actually signed and said, we're going to let you have Ukraine part of the Crimea Peninsula.
Obviously, as Joe kind of alluded to, the chances of us going militarily here are pretty much zero because, you know, Russia has nuclear weapons pointed at us. But is there kind of a disconnect or maybe some differences in response to, let's say, if what happened in Libya than what is happening in Russia? Because, you know, when there's human rights abuses going on in Libya, we essentially bombed Tripoli. But when we get into a situation where one of the bigger countries is apparently, you know, engaging in human rights abuses, it seems like our course of action is a lot more limited. Is there a disconnect there, or is that just reality geopolitically?
I think it's geopolitical reality. But I would also – it speaks to a couple of things. First of all, before we would do anything, I think you really got to talk to the Ukrainian government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we just can't make assumptions. Hey,
Correct.
We know what's best.
Correct.
Because they may not want military U.S. forces or European forces
right.
on their soil.
Well, especially when they're changing leaders right now.
Right. So that's issue one. Strength, and this is timely because of the president's just – rolled out budget, and the military is on the cutting axe as far as spending. We do spend a lot for our military. It's almost half of our discretionary budget. But is this world a safer world or a more dangerous place? And I think now there's probably some reevaluation of those numbers based upon not just this Crimea thing, but braggadocio Putin has been, and also the discussions of the nuclear arsenal and all this pretty scary talk. So it does show the importance of being militarily strong.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, what you said kind of at the onset of this topic is that United States and European allies should lay the groundwork for those three countries you mentioned, Moldova, Georgia, and Ukraine, to be part of NATO. How do you think Russia would react to something like that? And would that cause political blowback that a country that's literally on its border might join an alliance that they've viewed for suspicion for decades?
I know exactly how they respond because you have other countries, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, who are right on the Russian border. I think timeliness is everything, and the fact that I've been in many discussions where the Russians and the Western Europeans, I want to include those in this debate, were concerned about NATO going up to the Russian border.
Mm-hmm.
But it has happened in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Now, I would argue that it would happen because they came in on and around September 11th, right after that. I think there was other threats. You had different leadership in Moscow.
Although Putin was still behind the scenes.
He was still behind the scenes, but not strong enough to stop this expansion in the Baltics. So they've lost that. Answering your question, I think they would not be very happy with it. But because once you are officially a member of NATO, that's why I use the term membership action plan. Membership action plan is not membership. But it is a signal that if they transform, that we should consider their invitation to join NATO. But then you have the real deal, right?
Mm.
Why can Russia go into Georgia? Because they're little countries that can't defend themselves against a big, monstrous neighbor. Why do they go into Ukraine? Well, because that's a little country. Why will not Russia go into Turkey? Why won't they go into Greece? Or why will they not go into the Baltics? Well, because they're now protected under the NATO umbrella and the Article 5 of NATO.
Now, you know, Russia's big thing the last couple decades has been like the oil, its oil and gas reserves. And I mean, the free market from that standpoint has really put Russia in a stronger economic position so that Putin has money to spend on this stuff. So, and but it also means that Europe is more reliant on the energy. So you want to talk about that a little bit?
I mean, that's a great question because we'll move on the bill, a LNG export bill. And now with new gas reserves and oil, we're becoming an energy exporter. I know Lithuania has built a LNG import terminal. They're already seeing the benefits. The ship is being moved right now from where it was built in South Korea to the Baltic Sea, which will they'll unload the LNG and put it in their pipelines. That has already put them in a position to negotiate even better natural gas rates with Russia. But energy extortion, political involvement, and military threats are the tools in the Russian tool bag on destabilizing their neighbors. And the frustrating thing about this debate is both sides of the border would be better off. The average Russian, the average Ukrainian would be better off with peace and stability and the ability of free flow of goods and services. But under this regime, that's not going to happen.
How do you think the president has handled this situation?
I think fair. It's difficult. I will grant you that. I think when you send signals, you're going to cut your military. When you make proclamations of red lines, and then you don't fulfill any really military strength. I think he is not viewed as a strong international leader.
But on the other hand, one thing I was curious about was, and I think you may be very well be right, even among other countries when they're looking at President Obama right now. But on the other hand, does it weaken the GOP's case when they blast him for not being a strong leader, yet they turn around and go after him for unilaterally doing this, that, or the other on domestic? I mean,
like Syria, for example.
Yeah. Do they need to have more of a message? Either he's a strong leader or he's not.
Hey,
you see what I mean?
I'm the first one to make the proclamation that we're schizophrenic and inconsistent.
Well,
so,
I mean,
you know,
breaking
now the
news.
Democrats have even more worse trouble.
Yeah.
So,
I do think different regions of the world are different. I never spoke against the Libya activity.
I noticed that, yes.
Syria, and very difficult to get to. And I was very concerned that we would be drawn into something there that we couldn't get out of. I did speak against that. But
what do we do with Iran?
Well, we're concerned of their nuclear arsenal and what their nuclear arsenal to be and the destabilizing effect, not just to the state of Israel, but all the Arab countries around there.
Well, and the fact that they have close ties to Russia, which is one of the reasons I'm bringing this back,
yeah,
is that Iran and Russia have somewhat close ties. So are there concerns about that?
Right. No,
that there could be blowback from this situation.
Right.
Dealing with Iran.
You are correct.
We should probably transition to our next topic. You've been telling us a little bit about a toxic chemical spill. Give our listeners a brief recap of what's going on there.
Well, not the spill, but there's been spills, and so it does segue into how do we know what we have and how do we know those chemicals are safe? And it goes back to a law that was passed in 1976. Now, as I was telling Council High School today, I visited them. I was in that classroom where I was speaking in 1976 with my silk shirt and my plaid bell bottoms and my platform shoes. Not a pretty sight. So just transition that to a federal law that was passed based upon then known science.
Correct.
Versus today's known science and also handling and exposure and the like. Everyone would argue we have to update this. So we've got a bill called Chemicals and Commerce Act. I think the word was well taken. You know, in this studio, the chemical manufacturing industry would say 95% of everything here was touched by chemical manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is that mean that it's all toxic and we're all going to eventually, you know, die because of our contact?
Of course not.
Of course not. But should we know what we have and should we prioritize that and should we then use sound science to determine If it's safe, let people know it's safe. If it needs to be specially handled, make sure that people know it's specially handled. If it's highly toxic, can we eventually move to another chemical to replace it? That's kind of the basis of the legislation. Very excited about it. I'm working closely with some Democrats on the other side. There is a bipartisan bill in the Senate. It was Lautenberg before he passed, yeah. And it was Vitter, David Vitter, and now it's Vitter and Udall. Mm-hmm. That kind of started the ball.
Which Udall?
It is Tom Udall from New Mexico.
Correct.
And that started the ball moving forward that there is some middle ground on this. We've taken that and done a little more due diligence and cleaned up the language, but we need a big bipartisan vote on the floor to wake up Senator Barbara Boxer that we do have a bipartisan bill. And that's what we're trying to get
why,
to.
Why is she important in this? I take it she doesn't like
Well, Udall. There's an issue of, again, going back to the energy and commerce and the debate of interstate commerce. And there are some states who think they're smarter than the average bear, and they think that they're smart enough to determine what chemicals are safe and not safe for the public use. So they'll pass state-specific prohibitions, which then make it very difficult for interstate commerce, especially in these type of goods, to happen.
Are you referring to California?
That could be one of them. It happens to be the state where
Senator
Boxer
is from.
But there are others that have moved in some direction. So So our argument is let's make sure the EPA, you know, I'm a conservative Republican. Every time I say
right.
You know that I could get a lot of blowback, but let's make sure that they can they do the job they're tasked to do to identify the chemicals, prioritize them, and tell us which ones are safe, so that we can use them in commerce and tell us which ones need to watch out for.
What types of chemicals are we talking about here?
All of them. That's the problem with the 76 bill. There's only about we think 2,800 in commerce today. There's 200 we think are really bad.
Right.
There's 80,000 on the list, and the problem is that law was dysfunctional, where there's no ability to check the ones currently on the list were already grandfathered. So we need to go back and start looking at these grandfathered chemicals.
So let's transition into the politically speaking podcast. I've said that like six times, and it sounds terrible each time. But as an Illinois native, this is a fun fact. From the day I was born to the day I graduated high school, Illinois had a Republican governor from 1984 to 2002. And then 2002, our good friend Rod Blagojevich won the governorship, and it's been a Democratic governor domination ever since. In fact, in 2006, even though Rod Blagojevich had a 30% or below approval rating, he still won the governorship by 10 percentage points. So that kind of signals how bad your party has done on this front in the last 12
That's
to
true.
Something years. But this year there's a little bit more hope because Pat Quinn, Blagojevich's successor after Blagojevich went to jail, and an Illinois tradition, of course, also is very unpopular for various reasons. In fact, I saw a poll where he actually had sub-30 approval ratings. But I guess in typical Illinois Republican form, there's a pretty crowded primary.
Which is tomorrow. Which is Tuesday.
Which is tomorrow between Bruce Rauner.
Or today when people are listening.
Yeah. Either way. Bruce Rauner, a Chicago businessman. Bill Brady, the 2010 nominee who's from Bloomingdale. Kirk Dillard, who was also ran in 2010. I believe he's from suburban Chicago. And Treasurer Dan Rutherford, who's had some issues, so to speak, lately. So you haven't endorsed anybody in this.
I have not.
What's kind of your thought about this primary and kind of whether you think Republicans are going to break this streak of futility this year?
Well, where the race is now at is a two-man race. It's either Bruce Rauner, who's a wealthy fund manager who's been personally funding his campaign, running on trying to be like a Scott Walker or Mitch Daniels
right.
Or John Kasich.
Yes.
Going after waste, fraud, abuse,
and
government pensions,
and unions.
And so he has spent a lot of money, having a lot of money. He got out early. He's been able to hold, I think, his lead. And I think most people think, in the end of the day, he's our nominee. Dillard's closing the gap. He's a state senator from the suburbs. conservative, but also it's kind in of, your neck of the woods. Yeah. So, you know, those more moderate
guys.
Well,
I'm from Mark Kirk's former congressional district, and I would say that's like the last bastion of liberal to moderate Republicanism in the country, although Schneider kind of ended that Republican in 2012. But continue, as you were saying.
But so I think it's a two-man race now. I think Dillard is closing. It's just interesting who I hear from folks now that they got to make a cast a vote, and people are calling me and asking me. I'm not telling them how I voted. But
and you did already vote.
But I did. I voted early on Saturday, which I love. I'll be on the road all day Tuesday. So early voting was a great opportunity. The challenge will be Quinn is really disliked in the state. He is a populist, though. Right. Probably followed his career, and he can he does have that populist message. But the state of Illinois is in disarray financially, and it's really at a bigger crisis than a lot of people believe. And it's hard for me to say since I'm in Washington, but we're equally dysfunctional, budgetarily. So I can really call out Illinois because based upon experience. So.
Understood. Now, we've had a couple of instances of self-funding businessmen run for office in Missouri. We had John Bruner, who lost the U.S. Senate primary to our good friend Todd Akin. And we had Dave Spence, who actually became the gubernatorial nominee against Jay Nixon. And both were able to fund their own campaigns and spend a lot of money, but both of them didn't win. And Rauner, while I suppose he doesn't have a voting record, which I think probably hurt Brady in 2010, is he going to kind of suffer from that same kind of problems that self-funding candidates have, especially with him? I believe the Sun-Times reported that he said he was in the 0.01% or something like that, and that might have stung him a little bit. Could he fall into some of those same traps?
Yes. I mean, he'll get Romneyed. Right. When you have a lot of money and you're spread it around a lot, there'll be some businesses that you were successful in raising up. There'll be some businesses that you were involved with that failed. It's just a difficult thing. Illinois really also has a history of not having rich guys get in the race and not getting across the finish line. And we could Al Holfield and you could just go and name them.
Jack Ryan in 2004. That's how we got Alan Keyes to run for a U.S. Senate seat.
How Obama got in the Senate. But so when you – does Rauner also mobilize if he wins? Does that mobilize the labor forces in Illinois and kind of – who may not be thrilled with Quinn, especially over some of the pension cuts? Does that kind of set that up as well? Do they see then as well – I mean, Republicans managed to counter labor power in Wisconsin – Michigan and Indiana, notably. I'm talking about these three neighbors, forgetting Ohio, but just talking about those. So does that set up this kind of get more of a labor versus corporate struggle? And does that have anything to do with why Rauner's closest rival is closing the gap a bit? Or is there things at play?
It's really – Illinois is a bizarre state. So that is a threat that organized labor has been telling a lot of elected officials. If Rauner is elected, we are all in, and it's going to hurt people down the line. The whole issue of a lot of Dillard's financing is coming from organized labor.
Yes.
Well, that's what I'm getting into.
Yeah. Yeah, so not only the tax on Rauner, but also the positive Dillard and so that's why I think he's closing the gap. I do think there are people worried about the down ballot issues, but I think the labor might have other having the state in as governor is a big thing for them, but I've got to believe losing the U.S. Senate is a bigger threat. So money may go in that direction or other than in this race.
To help Pat Quinn. But just kind of stepping back a little bit, as somebody who has followed Illinois' troubles, because maybe from a personal level, could a Republican governor really make a difference in the situation there? It seems like they're in such financial straits. I mean, I guess Indiana and Wisconsin are have ads trying to get businesses there. I'm guessing Missouri doesn't do that because Nixon doesn't want to upset a Democratic governor, but What difference would a Republican governorship make, especially if the legislature is overwhelmingly Democrat and could override any of his vetoes?
Well, we have a supermajority right now.
Right.
And so the bottom line is it would make it – it's still going to be very, very difficult. But for – if you want even a seat at the table, you need to have the Republican governor, even just to have someone there. So that's the counter argument. If we've got to get the fiscal position, so let them pass something and let them move it through with the supermajority. But my guess is going to be a stronger Republican year. We're gonna have pickups across the board. We'll have pickups in the state legislature and the state senate. Not enough to take the majority, but enough to adjust the supermajorities on the veto.
Do you see a replay of 2010, or will it be different, and how?
Well, 2010 was
huge.
Just what 2006 was a huge Democrat year. So, my point is, this is really all dependent upon health care reform, and I think it just keeps going down the road like it's a flat tire, right? It's still going to move forward, but it's not going to move at 50, 60, 70 miles an hour. Hence, people are going to be disillusioned about it. It's the midterm of the second term of a president. That's a down year anyway. I just think that they're going to have a hard time turning out their vote.
One last thing. You're a congressman now. Are you looking ahead to maybe either running for a higher state office yourself or for Senate down the road?
No. Politically, you've talked to politicians all the time. You never say never, right? You never, because you guys will play that back to us when we make when we change our mind.
Yeah.
So you never say never, but when you represent 33 counties and you have to fly back and forth to Washington, and then you still have a 14-year-old home and a wife who will still welcome you home, that's about for me to have to do anything bigger. I have spent a lot of time in Chicago and. That's a tough thing to do.
It's a scary place, man.
You know, the Cubs are up there, and, you know,
hey,
I don't want to get involved with
that. I'm a White Sox fan.
That's the easy Chicago out. Don't ask me. I'm a White Sox fan. So.
My wife, who's a Southsider, is a Cubs fan for some reason. But, you know, she's has misplaced priorities.
Yeah, it just doesn't work.
All right. Well, we'll close it off there. As a quick programming note, we're posting this on Tuesday, but we will have another show on Thursday, and that is with St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley.
It's a double dose of politically speaking.
Yes, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Yeah, they can listen online or on iTunes. Yeah. And we're very excited. This is great. We're really excited to have had the congressman today.
Yes. So to close this out here, you can read all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. Jason?
Jay Rosenbaum.
Joe?
Jay Manis. It's JManNIES.
Do you have a Twitter account, a Twitter handle?
I do, but I have no idea what it is. So,
an honest comment.
You know, house.gov/Shimkus. Go to the website.
Is it at Rep John's Shimkus or something?
Just type in GOOGLE.
I've gotten so many of them wrong lately that I just want to make sure that I actually got right.
That's okay. This is great. Appreciate
it. It's actually Rep Shimkus.
Very good.
Rep Shimkus.
Very clever.
Very good.
Very clever.
Well, we'll be back next week. Until then, so long.
So long.
So long.